ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 4th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, why the Reserve Bank is widely tipped to keep interest rates on hold in this afternoon's Melbourne Cup Day decision. And the changing sounds inside the juvenile justice system.
I've been through some things like the fate, but I've learned I'm going to do this.
It's a gift to all the boys in here because I know a lot of the boys, they just need that. They need someone that understands them, someone that's been in their shoes, you know.
The boys at Cobham love a bit of a freestyle. Yeah. Do you want to rock one for us?
Hey, do a freestyle. Meanwhile, this is Constant Pros. I'm going to get it, let them go. Hey, yo.
The offer of free electricity for some households has sparked debate about whether it's the best way to reduce growing power bills. The federal government's plan would offer energy users with or without solar panels the choice to opt in for 3 hours of free power every day from next July in three states. Consumer groups say it will work for some, but broader policies are needed too, as Stephanie Smale reports.
Washing machines, dishwashers, air conditioners and heaters chew up the most energy in Australian homes, and the federal government wants people who can to run them in the middle of the day. That's when the free power offer will be available for homes with smart meters. Brian Spack from Energy Consumers Australia says it might suit some.
People who work from home, anyone really who spends a lot of the day at home, but not all households are able to do that. And so if you can't do it, then it might not really be an offer that's best for you.
Brian Spack says a recent survey of 4,000 households revealed about half do want a scheme like the Solar Share plan, but the other half would prefer a more straightforward option.
We think it's just as important that the default market offer provide a easy, affordable option for all households, even one that doesn't change throughout the day, but one that just is a flat, affordable price.
The scheme will roll out first in New South Wales, Southeast Queensland and South Australia from next year. But the shift has shocked energy retailers, who are warning prices could go up at other times of the day or force smaller retailers out of the market. Australian Energy Council CEO Louisa Kinnear argues the federal government should have consulted the industry.
Many retailers actually offer this type of product in the market right now. So I think our key frustration is that we don't feel that government needed to introduce a regulated product for this offer, given that many retailers across the industry are already doing it and doing it on their own terms in a way that works for retailers and in a way that works for customers.
Well, it's not a silver bullet and it is part of a suite of measures, but, you know, it's a good one.
The Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, is powering ahead with the plan. He argues the Australian Energy Regulator will monitor any price impacts from the policy.
Making sure that those offers, which are, you know, particularly important for those people who aren't particularly engaged in the energy market, don't change providers very often, but that their best interests are protected and that prices aren't pushed up unduly in other parts of the day.
As the federal government looks for ways to manage power bills now, the coalition is trying to sort out its power plans for the future. The Liberals have been plunged into another climate change policy crisis after the Nationals abandoned the 2050 net zero target. Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce has been lobbying for the shift, sitting out party meetings in his stand against the target.
We've just moved the whole agenda to exactly where I want it to be. I think I'm going quite well. It's almost like I've done it before.
As the parties try to sort out their position, Liberal frontbencher Andrew Bragg has made his views clear.
I think this is a real moment for leadership now, not backsliding, because our job here is not to worry about what people's personal preferences might be. It's really about setting out a long-term course for the nation which protects and guards against climate change, which of course we have to do by working with other nations.
Andrew Bragg says he doesn't want the coalition's marriage to end, but he's adamant the 2050 net zero target should stay.
Well, there's a reason you have divorce laws, I guess, but we would be much better served to stay with the Nationals because we have given Australia good government over this last 80 years. So that would be my strong preference, but it's not at any cost.
Liberal MP Andrew Bragg, ending that report by Stephanie Smale. Well, the Reserve Bank will announce the rate that stops the nation later today, although the RBA is widely tipped to keep interest rates on hold after last week's shock inflation data, likely to sort of temper hopes of a rate cut this side of Christmas. Jo Masters is Chief Economist at Barrenjoey Capital. She joined me earlier. Jo, just how seismic was that inflation data for economists and market watchers who were hoping that the worst of that inflationary cycle was over?
Well, it was a material shock. And as you say, we had been looking for, you know, some moderation in inflationary pressures in the economy. And as Governor Bullock has said on many occasions, inflation hurts all Australians. And so the overriding objective, of course, has to bring inflation back down. But actually what we saw in the September quarter was an acceleration in inflation. In annual terms, accelerated to 3% from 2.7. That puts it at the very top of the RBA's policy target band. And perhaps more worryingly, that acceleration in inflation came from domestic pressures, partly around the housing market, so rents and construction of new houses, but also actually what we call market services. And they are things that everyday Australians use. So it's things like hairdressers, for example, eating out, takeaway.
The RBA governor also recently came out to say that in the current geopolitical and domestic landscape, we've become too comfortable with risk and maybe that there's a correction ahead. What did you make of those comments?
Well, I think she's right to point out that we are living in a world that is more uncertain than it was pre-pandemic. You know, if we think about the last 5 years, globally, the economy and financial markets have had to absorb a number of what economists call supply side shocks. And so these are shocks that come, they're unanticipated, and they impact the ability of the economy to provide goods and services. And geopolitics and how that plays through supply chains, we obviously had the pandemic, we've had high inflation, we've had a number of other shocks, and we've got some big structural challenges coming around things like energy transition and AI, for example. And yet we've got economic outlooks that look reasonably complacent. Economic growth forecasts from the IMF, for example, last week are reasonably benign. And of course, equity market valuations quite stretched. So there does seem to be this disconnect between this sort of comfort about how economies are plodding along and equity markets and this underlying sense of ongoing uncertainty and shock after shock.
So do you agree that rates will stay on hold today? Because there is an argument to suggest that if inflation isn't under control, that perhaps they should go up. What do you think, and what do you predict in terms of more midterm decisions by the Reserve Bank?
I think the Reserve Bank will leave interest rates on hold this week. In the last month, we've had this inflation shock data, but we also had an unemployment shock data with the unemployment rate rising to 4.5%. And so I think the board needs to see more information as it balances those two risks. At the end of the day, it's quite a complex economic outlook, both those global shocks that you talked about and geopolitics and Trump's tariffs, but also domestically, we're seeing this persistence in inflation, but some underlying weakening of the labour market. And that's going to require Governor Bullock and the board to handle monetary policy with kid gloves. And at the moment, they just need a little bit more evidence. So we think they hold today. And when we look further ahead, we think the RBA actually holds interest rates at this 360 level for a period of time. They believe that policy is slightly restrictive. So that means they believe that interest rates are working a little bit against inflation. And in time, we think inflation will start to moderate into the inflation band. So we think there's the potential for one or two more rate cuts, but not until the second half of calendar year 2026. That's a long way away.
Indeed. Jo Masters is Chief Economist at Barrenjoey Capital. Many thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Trackside or otherwise, many punters will enjoy a Melbourne Cup Day flutter today. And while figures from Racing Victoria reveal Aussies still like to place a bet on the big race, they also reveal cost of living pressures are impacting betting more broadly. It comes as the latest household spending figures show it's only the essentials on the shopping list, as Tanya Dendrinos reports.
It's Melbourne Cup Day and 19-year-old Elsie is on her way to the race, but she's sticking to a budget.
I actually brought the concession tickets, which were quite cheap, and then I also ended up making my own outfit. So the fascinator I brought a few materials from Spotlight and Lingcraft, and then the dress itself I thrifted for $10, then sort of upcycled.
She's just moved out of home and says it's been a tough adjustment.
So I actually have three jobs. So and still even then, I can't actually pay for my own rent. So my parents are unfortunate enough to have them to support me.
And while a special occasion flutter is on the cards for many today, Australian households aren't generally splashing cash on the finer things. Jake has just moved to Melbourne from Newcastle and says he's had to cut his spending right back just to afford the basics.
We're paying a lot. It's probably nearly all my paycheck just in rent and shopping. And yeah, we can't even go out and do stuff on the weekends and stuff like that. We're struggling.
While Sydney woman Silka has given up on waiting for any future interest rate cuts, her mortgage has become so unaffordable she's had to put her house back on the market just 3 years after she bought it.
Yeah, literally it went from sub 3% to over 7%. It's come down slightly to around 6%, but it's still more than double. And I can't double the tenant's rent, obviously, so I have to make up the shortfall and it's just becoming too much of a burden.
The latest household spending figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics reveal a slight increase in September, but that rise was just 0.2%, both for the month and also the September quarter. The minimal rise wasn't on discretionary items, with the ABS saying it was instead driven by households spending more on things like food, health and petrol. Dr. Cassandra Goldie is the CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service.
The data doesn't surprise us. We know that far too many people are really struggling to make ends meet, particularly people on low and modest incomes. They are spending every dollar to cover the essentials, and there's very little room for anything extra. Food has become, for many people, a discretionary item. We know, for example, people on JobSeeker, which is just $400 per week, are 14 times more likely to be going without one substantial meal a day than the general population.
How concerning is this for you, and what do you think needs to be done to turn it around?
The community sector all over Australia has been raising the alarm bell for a long time. We know that people on the very lowest incomes are at the front end of this crisis. We need to be investing more in public and social housing. We need to fix the adequacy of social security payments. JobSeeker and youth allowance are unbearably low and simply do not help people to cover the essentials of life. And of course, we need to be accelerating the energy transition to make sure that we're providing access to the best of the technologies for people to reduce their energy bills, particularly for people on low and modest incomes.
ACOS CEO Dr. Cassandra Goldie, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos and Bridget Fitzgerald. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Overseas now, and Israel has been rocked by a political scandal at some of the highest levels. The country's top military lawyer has been jailed after admitting she leaked a video of Israeli soldiers allegedly sexually assaulting a Palestinian detainee. The Israeli Major General has since resigned from her job and, for a brief period, went missing. Nicole Johnston reports, and a warning, this story contains some graphic detail.
It is brutal footage, and it aired on Israel's Channel 12 last year. The video appears to show masked Israeli soldiers inside the Stateman detention centre. In it, the soldiers select a Palestinian detainee and take him out of view of the cameras. Emmanuel Fabian is the Times of Israel's military correspondent, speaking here to the BBC.
According to the indictments that were filed against five of these reserve soldiers, the soldiers severely beat and assaulted the prisoner, leaving him with very severe injuries, including broken ribs and an internal tear in his rectum, apparently from a sharp object that he was basically stabbed with.
Now a controversy has blown up in Israel over who leaked the video. Major General Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, who was the top military advisor in the Israeli Defense Forces, admitted she did it and has been arrested. In her resignation letter, she wrote,
"I approve the release of the material to the media in an attempt to counter false propaganda against the army's law enforcement authorities."
Jeremy Sharom, the legal affairs reporter for the Times of Israel, says for a short time, overnight, no one knew where she was.
She was missing for about an hour. She was meant to meet with her lawyer. and she was uncontactable for about an hour at least. And there was a big search by police and other rescue services trying to find her. Eventually, she was found.
On a Tel Aviv beach, what happened next has raised even more questions. Her phone, a key part of the evidence, was missing. She says she lost it. But there was also a suicide note. However, police say it's unclear whether this indicated a clear intention to kill herself. Right-wing Israeli commentators and politicians have blasted the former Major General.
The sentiment amongst, as I said, parts of the population, particularly the right and hard right, is that we cannot prosecute our own soldiers when we're fighting such a terrible war against such a brutal enemy. And that's all coming to a head here in this case, because Tomer Yerushalmi said the reason she leaked the video in the first place was because after the arrests of those suspects, she was inundated with huge criticism.
From Gaza to a defence industry conference in Sydney, where more than 100 people protested against the war and clashed with police.
We're here protesting the Indo-Pacific Weapons Expo, which has people that have been privy to the last 2 years of genocide in Gaza. We were here protesting. We're up the front. We didn't even leave the park, and cops entered. This is an area we were told we were allowed to protest in. All we did was walk right up to the barriers. Cops came straight in. And the pepper sprayed so many of us. There's about almost 24 of us here now that I can see.
Yasmin Johnston from Palestine Action Group says companies with links to Israel's defence industry should not be allowed to attend.
We organised this protest of the Indo-Pacific Weapons Expo because we think it's shameful that the New South Wales government has invited war criminals who have broken international law, sold weapons that Israel has used in Gaza, to our city.
The debate over this war continues to make waves.
Nicole Johnston there with help from Diana Damjanovic. Should new driver training in Australia now also cover how not to drive a car? That's one of the suggestions for self-driving cars, which still require driver supervision, something current licensing and road safety frameworks were not designed for. A federal government strategy for high-tech road transport released last week said little about these cars, which can follow routes from start to finish, handle intersections, change lanes, even respond to traffic lights. Dr. Angus McCarroll is a research fellow in psychology at the University of Melbourne, studying human factors in road safety. He joined me earlier. Dr. McCarroll, cars like these are, in fact, on the road in Australia right now, but you say laws and frameworks around them aren't keeping pace. How?
Yeah, so, I mean, when we saw mobile phones introduced and became the norm around the place, we had to update our road laws if we were going to reduce the risk of harm. And I think that's the same sort of level of challenge that we're seeing now with the introduction of the so-called supervised self-driving. So, you know, every jurisdiction in Australia has some version of a road rule that requires the driver to maintain control of the vehicle, but now not having control is actually a feature by design. So we need our laws to keep up with that, but to do that, we also need our systems to be safe.
I mean, there are design rules and safety frameworks around seatbelts when they are installed in cars, but seatbelts don't require software updates like some of these features in self-driving cars. So what regular monitoring of safety data must these manufacturers undertake?
I mean, I think there are a whole pile of different features that we could be pulling out and requiring manufacturers to pull out. So places like California that require manufacturers to collect disengagement report on disengagements from partial automation as well. So when that transition happens between control from the vehicle to the driver and back and forth, especially in critical scenarios, that can't just be just still lost. Things like engaging automatic emergency braking, automated emergency braking, and those critical safety features, having those to be able to report on and show the performance of these systems and when they're not performing, crucially, is really important and would help with crash investigations.
You and your fellow authors were more or less underwhelmed with the federal government's strategy for high-tech road transport released last week, not really going into too much detail specifically about this function for self-driving cars. What more could the government be doing then?
I think having some kind of either training around people, having some kind of registry, we don't have the skills in place or the requirement for either people to know how to use these systems at a training level, but we also don't have any requirement for manufacturers to be accountable for what happens when their systems don't perform the way people expect them to. So we talk about these names, as you said, getting away from the feature itself, but we talk about names like self-driving, and I think that evokes a certain image about what a system can do to people. And I think that's very reasonable. So I think what we need is either for those names to comply with what that evokes in someone when they're thinking about these systems, but also to give people the opportunity to learn how to use them in a controlled and a rigorous manner. So part of that goes to the idea of licensing frameworks. States have driver knowledge tests, I think, in New South Wales, and the requirement to learn how to drive a manual car. And if you don't learn how to drive a manual car, you're not permitted to actually use one. Part of this could be around a requirement to actually learn how to use these automated systems in a safe way.
There's plenty in those driver tests about parallel parking and some of those other kind of nightmare situations for new drivers. Can you imagine a framework in which new drivers are taught how not to drive, how to drive vehicles which have capabilities to self-drive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in a scenario where we're teaching people how to use a thing that they don't have to use most of the time, but it goes in line with a lot of safety training. You know, we're teaching people how to respond in a low frequency event. So in these scenarios, it's not 90% of the road time where the system is performing the way you expect it to. What we need people to know how to do is respond when the system fails, and inevitably the systems will fail, and the person needs to know quickly and effectively what they're meant to do in that scenario.
Dr. Angus McCarroll is a research fellow in psychology at the University of Melbourne. Really nice to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks, Eddie.
The sounds heard inside juvenile detention centres aren't always happy nor inspirational, but a new radio station is running 24/7 inside a Western Sydney correctional facility using music and mentorship to try and break the cycle of reoffending. Sarah Forster has the story.
At just 13, Jordan Carlin spent Christmas Day behind bars. It wasn't the Christmas he wanted, but it was better than the one waiting outside.
It was wild getting socks and lollies, you know. Like, who knew that a pair of socks would, like, make your day? I remember thinking, I didn't get shit on the outside.
Now, more than a decade later, the former inmate is sitting behind a microphone in a recording studio trying to help others find their way.
Thanks for joining us on Futures Radio. We are going to do a cons and pros episode. Hear his story, what he's been through, and how he's turned it all around.
Jordan Carlin is part of a new 24/7 radio station broadcasting into the youth justice system. It's the brainchild of Dominic Brooke, who previously worked in juvenile justice.
The boys didn't have a lot of positive media. It was normal TV, that's a lot of crime shows, and also hanging out with the other boys that had been in trouble with the law. And it was a moment that one of the boys said to me, he said, you know, in here I've learnt to become a better criminal. And that's because he's hanging out with other boys on the unit that are teaching him other tricks. And I'm like, how can that be? Like, how do we harness the time and shift the culture so they're learning to be a better individual? So they're learning about how to have a great future and overcome the past.
The station is heard in Western Sydney's Cobham Juvenile Justice Centre, while some segments are also played into other facilities around New South Wales. Dominic Brooke and his team, Musicians Making a Difference, ask the boys what they wanted to hear. And
last week, some of the boys were like, I want a quote of the day. I want to do breath work in the morning so we can automate these beautiful programs and night reflections, cultural stories, hip hop shows. And I think they've refined it also to the music that they like. So they've got their own hour where they can request songs, and it's become part of their life.
Former detainee Jordan Carlin has been on a number of episodes and relishes the chance to act as a mentor.
On the very first one we were on, I explained, you know, my story and where I come from and the challenges I've had, you know, in and out of juvie, single father, you know, grew up as a kid in foster care, that sort of stuff. They listen, they respect what you say, they listen because, oh, he's been there, done that. I would rather listen to them than, you know what I mean, someone who's studied a book.
For detainees like this young man who can't be named, it's like nothing he's experienced before.
It's a gift to all the boys in here, because I know a lot of the boys, they just need that. They need someone that understands them, someone that's been in their shoes, you know.
Dominic Brooke says it's not just radio. For the boys on air, it's a fresh start. And for those listening, it's a way to spend their time behind bars improving themselves. Jordan Carlin says he could have used a radio program like Futures during his time in custody.
I don't think I would have gone back as many times as I did if I had, you know, Futures. There's a pathway that they can follow, you know, to create their own success and stuff like that, which is incredible.
Rapper Jordan Carlin, ending that report by Sarah Forster. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For months, there's been great hope of a November interest rate cut to coincide with the Melbourne Cup. But now, with inflation rising again, all bets are off. What have the three rate cuts already granted this year done to house prices? Today, finance expert Alan Kohler on why the only way is up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.